All right. I hope everyone's feeling refreshed after the tea break and ready to get on with the next session. So welcome, and you are here for the session titled "Building Trust in the Cloud." I hope everybody's here, and is anybody here in the wrong room? No? Okay, good. Today, my name is Jay, and I am a technology specialist with Microsoft on the Azure platform. I've been part of the Azure platform for the last 6 years in multiple roles, and currently, I focus on security, data privacy, and compliance, and work with customers who have concerns on those topics as they look at transitioning more and more workloads onto the cloud. I do this across the Asia region, and with me, I have Keshav. So, Keshav's the regional director. He's also a senior attorney with Microsoft, based out of Singapore, and he's currently part of the Digital Crimes Unit. The way we are going to be talking today is the talk will have two parts to it. So the first part, I'm going to be talking about what are the capabilities, features that we have on Azure to ensure that the customer data, your applications that you host on Azure are safe, secure. How do we do that? How do we manage all of that? And what is it that we can provide with you in terms of sharing this information about what we do, how transparent we are with regards to what we do, and ensure that as a customer, you can trust Microsoft with your data and your solutions on our platform, right? And then Keshav will talk about some of our initiatives from a cybercrime and the cyber threat perspective. What is it that Microsoft does to ensure that that we keep the cyberspace safe? And also, what is the initiatives that Microsoft does, and how is it beneficial to customers such as yourself? How can you leverage some of the work that Keshav and his team do in the cybercrime space? So quickly, I just wanted to get a feel for the audience. So how many of you here are developers or IT pro? Okay, pretty much everyone. Okay. And how many of you have had questions or concerns regarding security and trust? Okay. So, all right. So I guess that means that you guys probably have quite a bit of questions about what we have to speak. And since we have a fairly packed content with regards to the time, what we'll do is we will set aside 10 minutes for 10 to 15 minutes for questions at the end of the session. So if you can hold on to your questions till the end of the session, that'll be great. And we'll definitely handle all those questions. And if not within the 15 minutes, we'll be around. Since this is the last session of the day, we can definitely hang around here in this room and extend it to ensure that all your queries are addressed. So from a Microsoft Cloud perspective, right, like I said, so Azure, we launched Azure in beta back in 2009, and then in 2010, since 2010, it's been a commercial offering. One of the things that I've been doing since 2010 is talking to large enterprise customers about Azure and public cloud, right? Until 2, 3 years ago, there used to be strong pushback, right? A lot of enterprise customers would say, no, 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 I cannot put my solution or data on a public platform. I would only put it on my own infrastructure, in my own data center. I need that control. I need to know what's happening. So public is a no-no. But of late, over the last 12 months or so, as I go and talk to a lot of CIOs, CSOs in large enterprise customers, there is no more pushback, right? They understand that public cloud is a reality, right? It could be for the benefits like the agility or the scale or the economic benefits that a cloud provides. It could be various reasons, but they realize that public cloud is here to stay. It's something that they need to embrace. Public cloud is going to complement or supplement their existing on-premise private cloud deployments and anything else that they may be having. And hence, they do not push back again on a public cloud deployment, whether it's an infrastructure or a platform deployment or it's a software as a service consumption from a public cloud. But instead, they are interested in understanding how they can maintain the same levels of compliance and regulatory requirements that they do on-premise. They want to understand what is it that we do, how do we, as a service provider, cloud service provider, help the customer manage their compliance requirements? How do we manage their data privacy requirements, right? So that's the subject that we talk about when you talk about security on the cloud. While this term of cloud computing is fairly new, and Azure itself is a new service, and so is most of our competition, Microsoft has been in the business of providing public services for over two decades now. Right? We established our very first data center back in 1989, and over the last two decades, we've been having public services such as Hotmail, MSN, and other things, through which we have been providing services to the public. We've been hosting public data on our platforms. So we have quite a bit of experience, or over two decades of experience to be specific, about how we handle customer data. So while we started with one data center, today we have over 20 data centers. I think you have heard this multiple times. We've got data centers all over the world. We have also launched, announced that we are launching a data center here, right here in Pune. And so Azure today has a fairly large global footprint. It's grown from about six data centers that we used to operate four or five years ago to close to 20 plus data centers today. And over the time frame also, right, so there was a memo about trustworthy computing that Bill Gates wrote back in 2003, right? That became pretty popular, where he talked about security and trust being one of the serious concerns that will evolve as the internet matures, right? One of the things that came out of that is the security development lifecycle, right? At Microsoft, we got into something called as a security development lifecycle, which basically is a process for how we develop software at Microsoft, right? All of our portfolio of products at Microsoft go through a security development lifecycle where developers are taught to be cognizant about the code they develop being prone to vulnerabilities, and there is checks and balances in how we go about developing new code, right? And as part of this, what this results in is one, reduces the severity of any vulnerability that could be in our code. Two, it also reduces the number of vulnerabilities. So we've been leveraging this security development lifecycle for about 10 years now, and a lot of our peers in the industry have also started leveraging this as a practice as they build software. And then we've got our Malware Protection Center and Digital Crimes Unit. And like I said, so we'll talk about what we do under some of these things a little later. And finally, compliance, right? Since 2010, since we launched the commercial launch of Azure, we've had multiple compliances. We've gone through multiple compliance audits, and we've got multiple certifications, starting from ISO and SOC, PCI, FESMA, and all of these. And the reason we do that is because that helps us share our controls and practices with the customer, right? As a customer, if you needed an ISO 27000 certification for your own solution, by leveraging the Azure platform, you automatically inherit that through us. Right, so that's been one of the reasons where we've invested heavily on compliance, and we'll talk about a little more and deeper on this as well as we go through this presentation. So while broadly we talk about security, right, as the topic, it's actually three individual components under this larger umbrella called security, right? So there is the actual security of the services that you are leveraging. Then there is the privacy for the data privacy of the data that you're hosting. And then there is the compliance, right? So we will go through all these three topics. So from a security perspective, like I said, we follow a very robust security development lifecycle for all of our product developments, and this includes Azure as well, right? Within Azure as well, we do follow the same security development lifecycle to ensure that there are very few vulnerabilities. And then from an operations perspective, we have a very streamlined operations that we follow in terms of how we operate our data centers, right? So these includes the likes of having physical barriers to our data centers, electric fences, biometric authentication and so forth for people to enter. And so all of that is today a standard in terms of how we operate, right? There's a background checks for employees, and so all of our contractors also go through the same background checks that Microsoft has for their employees. And all of these data centers are directly operated by us as well. The other thing that we do, which is a little different from the rest of the industry, is our strategy called Assume Breach. Typically, when you think about security in an IT landscape, you think about defense, right? You have multiple layers of defense, right? So you have defense at the networking firewall level, then you have a layer of defense at the host level, then you have a layer of defense at the application level, and so forth. So that's typically how you handle security, right? On Azure, we do that. Obviously, we do that. We do have multiple layers of defense. But what we also do is we go beyond that, and we have a strategy called Assume Breach, whereby we actually split our team into two, a red team and a blue team. And the objective of the red team is to actually try and hack onto our platform. So the red team is going to be looking for vulnerabilities, looking for ways to hack into our platform, and do all the kinds of things a malicious hacker would try and do, right? And the blue team is supposed to guard and ensure that they are thwarting all of the efforts of the red team. So on a continual ongoing basis, the red team and the blue team actually mount these war games where they test the platform. So we spend a lot of time and effort on doing this and trying to have some of the best minds at Microsoft play hacker and trying to test our own capabilities and our own platform capabilities quite extensively. And finally, from an incident response perspective, again, since we've been in this business for such a long time, we have a very streamlined way of how we handle an incident in case there's an incident. So right from the time when an incident is detected to the forensic, all the way to when the customer is informed about the incidents, and then on to the time where we provide the customer with forensic data in case they want to take legal action on enforcement into helping them through the incident. The other, from a security perspective, the other thing that we do is more from a network protection, right? As you all probably already know, right, at Azure, on Azure, from another customer's deployment, right? And as a customer, let's say if you had two individual deployments through two separate accounts, those would be considered to be two separate deployments, and you wouldn't be able to access one deployment from the other without going through the internet, right, and through the firewall that Azure provides. So we completely segregate the access between customers, the management system, and the internet. And the other thing that we now provide now is also through virtual networks and subnets, network security groups. We let you isolate, create your own subnet groups, create access control lists and so forth to have tighter control on the VMs and who gets access to the VMs, which VM can talk to which other VM in your deployment and so forth, right? So, and we also let you bring in your own IP address ranges as well. So you can bring in your own on-premise IP address range and do a domain join off the deployment on the cloud with your deployment on-premise and manage the entire as one logical deployment. So you can then apply the same policies that you apply on-premise to the deployments on the cloud. So there's multiple ways in which you can go ahead and secure your deployments on the cloud. And finally, from a connectivity perspective, right? So we have, while the standard internet connection, you can also use a site-to-site or a point-to-site VPN connectivity over the internet to connect from on-premise to the internet. And now we've also launched ExpressRoute, which is a dedicated MPLS kind of connectivity from on-premise to the cloud through a VPN. Identity and access, right? So we let you bring your AD onto the cloud, or you can leverage an Azure AD on the cloud. Right, you can leverage Azure AD as a service, and you can integrate that with your service systems on the or deployments on the cloud to actually enable single sign-on access. Right, so this could be single sign-on access to your deployments on the cloud, or this could be single sign-on access to other deployments that you're subscribing to, right? Office 365 or any other software as a service solutions that you're subscribing to. You can leverage Azure AD to provide the authentication. You can also get multi-factor authentication, right? With the AD Premium, you can get multi-factor authentication. And you can also monitor and protect access to the cloud apps, right? So basically, we give you the capability of isolating infected devices, right? If there are devices that in your network that are, these could be, when I talk about devices, this could be PCs or phones or tablets, and we can actually isolate them, and later Keshav will talk about how we actually enable this. And so from an identity and access perspective, we give you that full gamut of bringing AD onto the cloud and integrating all of the capabilities that AD provides with what you're doing on the public cloud environment. Data protection, right? So this is a very large concern that customers have, right? They're like, oh, my data is very, very sensitive. To every customer, their data is, obviously, that is very precious, and that is a commodity that you're trusting Microsoft with. And these are the commitments that we have from a data protection perspective, right? All of your data is encrypted, right? When it is being transmitted, it is always encrypted. All of your data is encrypted by being transmitted between the client location and Azure. And if you go in for geo-redundant data, whereby we will store your data across multiple locations, we will also encrypt the data when it is being backed up to the DR location, right? So while at transmission, the data is always encrypted, we do not encrypt it at rest. Okay, the reason we do not encrypt it as trust is, one, there's a cost associated with it, as well as there's a performance hit that is associated with it. So while we out of the box do not encrypt the data at rest, we give you the capability to encrypt the data yourself, right? We have multiple options, like you could use SQL TDE, BitLocker, or .NET cryptographic libraries, and multiple other options through which you can encrypt your own data. And also, as an architect, you are not going to be encrypting all of your data, because it does not make sense to be encrypting all of your data. There is probably certain critical fields of data that you would want to encrypt, right? And there's also, like I said, there's a significant performance cost that you pay for encryption and decryption. So it doesn't make sense to encrypt all of your data, which is why we do not encrypt it, but we give you the capability to choose and encrypt the data that you would like encrypted. Data segregation, yes. So we are very judicious in how we isolate and maintain each customer's data. Just like I spoke about how we isolate each customer's deployment through virtual VLANs and network segregation, we have similar ways through which we segregate each customer's data and maintain their data separately. Data location and redundancy. So as a customer, you choose which data center that you want to host your data out of, right? So today we give you the choice of choosing whether it's going to be one of our data centers in Asia, Europe, North America, Australia, right? And once you choose your data center, primary data center, your data will reside only in that data center. If you go for a geo-redundant option, we will replicate that data onto the other data center in the same region. So for instance, if you chose Europe and chose geo-redundancy, your data will only reside in the two data centers in Europe. It's not going to be transferred out of that region, right? So we give you complete control in terms of where you want to hold your data, and based on the, so there's a lot of requirements with respect to, especially if some of you are working for clients in the European region or in the US region, where they have very strict requirements about the residency of data. We can clearly adhere to those requirements because we handle the data, or we let you choose the data center from which you want to host the data. Finally, data destruction, right? So data destruction, we will wipe the data clean. We do not maintain multiple copies of your data. Once you delete your data, it's deleted on our disks, right? So we don't archive your data, right? We maintain multiple copies for redundancy, but we do not archive the data. And so once you delete it, it will be deleted. All the copies of the data will get deleted, right? And once it's deleted, the disk space is freed up. You know, even if you want to go back and look at it, you would not be able to recover it from the disks, right? So that's the kind of processes we follow. And in case of disk failure, we follow the standard NIST 8088 process for destruction of failed disks and so forth. So all of these, again, you know, we follow standard industry practices in terms of how we handle customer data and how we manage all of the customer's data. So the other aspect about privacy is nobody at Microsoft has access to your data, right? As Microsoft employees, we will never have access to your data. To us, your data is a black box, and we only manage that black box within which your data sits. So unless for some reason, like you have some troubleshooting requirement whereby I need to look at your logs, and you provide me access to your data to look at those logs or so forth, that's the only instances where Microsoft employees get access to your data and handle your data directly. Otherwise, whether it is within SQL database on the cloud or any of the Azure storage tables and blobs, we do not, as Microsoft employees, we do not have access to your data. Even in the situations where you provide us with access to your data, all of that is actually is all completely monitored. So the Microsoft employee who would have access to your data will have to have multi-factor authentication, and there is an audit trail of everything that he does as he goes through your logs and helps you with your troubleshooting. So in case there is any malicious intent or something, that will be captured. The other thing that we promise is never to use customer data for advertising, right? So we are the only ones, we are the only large cloud provider who makes this promise of never to use a customer's data for advertising and cross-selling and so forth, right? If you look at more of our major competitors in the space, they all do this, right? And this is one of the reasons we recently got the ISO 27018 attestation. It's a compliance attestation with regards to data privacy, and we are the first cloud provider to have that attestation. While our competitors will now probably try and catch up with us on it, right? We are the first ones to do it, and we were able to be there as the first ones because we adhere to this policy of not using customer data for advertising. And finally, with regards to contractual commitments, especially when it comes to healthcare customers, BFSI customers, we actually go the extra mile in terms of making contractual commitments to them and having additional contracts in place to meet certain specific requirements of those industries, right? So that's, again, something where we do these things and differentiate ourselves from the competition that we have in the space. Lastly, compliance, right? So when it comes to compliance, like in the earlier slide that I have put up, right, since 2010, we've added a lot of different compliance certifications that we have gone through for this platform. And this is a very, very significant investment by Microsoft. So if you look at it, right, this compliance certification, it's not a one-time thing, right? This is an annual thing. So we go through this process on an annual basis, and we have external third-party auditors who come in and evaluate our processes and give us the certification. the certification itself is available on the web publicly, and we also are open to sharing the actual auditor's report under a non-disclosure. Right? If Microsoft has a non-disclosure agreement with the customer, we will share the auditor's report to you under the non-disclosure terms of the non-disclosure agreement. Right? So again, these are things where we differentiate ourselves, and we are trying to be very, very transparent in terms of how we do this, right? Because, like I said, compliance is a very, very important subject through which you can meet your own requirements. As a large enterprise, you may have certain compliance requirements that you want to adhere to or that your industry needs to adhere to, and you can inherit that through Azure, right? This is the reason that, as Azure, we make this massive investment, right? As any individual customer, you would not be able to go through this kind of a investment. But as Microsoft, we are able to do this because of the scale at which we operate. Right? So we are continually going through an audit process. It's a continuous ongoing process where at any point in time, we are audited for a different type of compliance requirement, or we are also evaluating newer levels of compliance that we want to adhere to, right? And there is also certain local level compliances that we are now catering to. For instance, the UK government cloud on the slide is one example. We similarly have been certified for government purposes in regions like Australia and Singapore, and we probably will have something similar to meet the local requirements in India as well as our India data centers become generally available, right? And so, like I said, so this is a huge investment that we make from a compliance perspective, and we also share what we do from a cloud controls matrix in terms of, what is it that we do to keep your data and solutions safe. How do we meet these process requirements? How do we meet the requirements of these auditors and the industry compliance requirements, right? So those are things which we are very transparent and we share. All of this is available on our website. So if you go to azure.microsoft.com, under the support segment, there is a sub-segment called Trust Center, where you will find a lot of resources which talk about all of the compliance requirements that we have, as well as things like, we have a lot of white papers on how can you make your own deployments secure? How do you secure your deployments further? And what are the things that you need to worry about? Because on this platform, at the end of the day, it's a shared responsibility. There are certain things that Microsoft does to keep you secure, but there is also a responsibility on the customer to manage security at their application layer. Right? So the security has to be managed both at the platform layer and the application layer. And as Microsoft, we take ownership to manage the security at the platform layer. And as a customer, we need your support in ensuring that at the application layer also it is secure so that we can claim that your solutions and data are totally secure on a public cloud platform. And so there is a lot of content available online which talks about a lot of this. I think maybe the last slide may have the link. Otherwise, you could just go on to the Azure website and look for Trust Center. So with that, I'll hand it over to Keshav. Resourced, equipped,
and experience to fight cybercrime. So what you heard from Jay was a comprehensive overview of how we bring trust to our technology. We want our customers to feel safer. We want our customers to feel secure. And they should be able to understand what is happening with their data, what kind of information Microsoft is accessing or not accessing, how my privacy rights are controlled and reviewed. We come in as on top of all the enhancements and the advancements we have in terms of security that is built in into our products and services, we have gone a step ahead. For many, many years, we believe cybersecurity starts with fundamentals. You have to have value-added product services, then you have, on top of it, you have to have cloud. But then we also want to go take the security where the fight is against the cyber criminals. So DCU department is designed to fight cybercrime, and I'm going to walk you through how we do that, what kind of criminals have we fought, and how are we leveraging that threat intelligence that we generate out of combating cybercrime, which is helping our customers. And how is that enhancing our cloud technology to bring better intelligence at the doorstep of our customers so they are better informed and they can take better defensive measures. So let me start by talking about where is cybersecurity topic discussion going. You know, many years back, it was typically an IT department, a server room kind of a discussion. CIOs and CTOs and IT managers would primarily be held responsible for any cybersecurity issues, but that is no longer the case. Today, with the advancement of the sophistication of the attacks and how organized crime has taken on cybercrime in a very sophisticated way, that today it is directly impacting business. It is impacting the growth of the business. It's impacting business decisions. It can impact your customers. It can impact your reputation. It is no longer a single incident which would have caused some disruption. You're talking about massive attacks. You all know of Anthem Insurance Company, how it got attacked. You know the Sony hacking incidents, the JP Morgan hack. You think of Target, Home Depot. You go on, and the list is endless. You pick up a paper every second day, you're finding some form of security incidents being cited. So it has gone above just an IT. It has become a management responsibility, and that is something we all must imbibe, that it is a business issue. It is not just a technology issue. And the CIOs are very concerned about the trust. So when they are thinking of disruptive technologies, cloud technologies, they are also concerned. The top of the mind is, hey, when I choose a technology platform, can I trust that? You know, can I entrust my data to that technology provider? Does it have sufficient compliance? Does it have sufficient privacy principles? Does it bring the transparency do I need in that provider? And does it have, is it secure and safe? So let me ask you, and you think about it, when we all wake up in the morning, right? Millions, billions of people wake up in the morning, they switch on their to attack, to steal data, and to cause untold damage. They are one of the most potent forms of cyber criminal activity that we are observing. And this is what Digital Crimes Unit in Microsoft is entrusted to go after. Because we are talking about one of the most vicious forms of malicious crimes which are committed across the world. It impacts individuals, governments, businesses, students, universities. You think of an industry they are after, because they are stealing data, they're stealing money, and that is what our mandate is, to go and disrupt that cybercrime. Go after criminals and disrupt them, take over their servers, disrupt their operations, make their cost of operations higher, and make computers clean, and bring a big, better safety environment and ecosystem. So I'll discuss a bit of that, how we do it, and overall reduce digital risk as well, because we see that unsecure supply chain of IT is leading to all kinds of vulnerabilities coming in. And that's why you need to understand what trust means when you use technology. Vulnerable population is something, it's a Microsoft, I would say, a commitment to contribute to that section of the society which they cannot defend themselves that easily. You're talking about children who are using internet devices very frequently. You're talking about elderly people. You're talking about people who get trafficked, who are not educated enough, who cannot defend themselves. Technology is used to exploit them as well. And DCU is working on various areas to see how we can protect those section of vulnerable population. I will not go deep into this at all, but I'm sure you all know what photo DNA is. How many of you have heard of photo DNA? Well, I know you guys are developing software very deeply. Photo DNA is a technology which was built by Microsoft to protect children from sexual abuse on the internet. Young children, when they're on the internet, they get duped, they get conned by people, and they're sexually abused, and the images are, you know, exchanged on the internet. Pedophilia is very high on the internet. You'll be surprised how many images are out there. Photo DNA was developed, and I won't go more deep than that, was developed by us and Dartmouth College in US, whereby we can scan images and build a database of all the bad images, sexually exploited images of children in a database, and that law enforcement uses to track down who is trading on those images, and then they are able to raid and catch people. And it's a massive contribution. It has become an industry standard, and today enterprises are using PhotoDNA as a cloud service, and it is a free service. We donate it to law enforcement, and we are giving it free to enterprises, because that is our contribution, and that is our responsibility for a safer digital internet. So we use a lot of big technology, and that is where I find it exciting to be a part of this digital crimes unit, and I'll keep referring it to as DCU, so I'm sure you'll understand it's digital crimes unit, because we're doing very powerful technologies, big data analytics, cyber forensics, and we use our technologies of power mapping, power BI, our own Microsoft SharePoint, Dynamics, Office, Azure, and you will see some of the example. I'm going to give a demo of what that power mapping is all about. But this data is being used to study crime behavior, how malware is spreading, what kind of threat it is, who it is targeting, what is it customized for, where the victims are. Investigations, of course, we have deep technical, digital, and in-field investigation capabilities to detect crime. And we use a lot of private-public collaboration to bring the real value out of studying the cybercrime behavior. Legal action, that's our muscle. That's something we exercise rights, because if our platforms are targeted by criminals, we have a right to defend our platform, we have a right to defend our customers, and we have a right to defend our IP as well as to protect our vulnerable populations from being attacked. So we will see some of that example here. So we have a state-of-the-art cybercrime center, which was launched in 2013. It's an R&D facility where we are researching malware, where we are bringing partners. Partners include law enforcement, FBI, Europol, Interpol. They come to our center for research. We have industry partners. Financial sector comes to our center. Banks are coming to our center, and we are doing research. Universities are part of that network. The research goes on, and we are studying a malware. We're studying cybercrime, how it is evolving, what kind of advancements they are making, because they're very smart people. Those who are coding that malicious software to bypass technology, bypass checks, and maliciously attack, they are not dumb. They are very smart people. So for us, Microsoft can never do it alone, and we require a much broader collaboration. And this is the center, which is a state of the art, where we are able to study cybercrime like never before using big data analytics, investigation, and how we can drive legal action. So in terms of the actions we have done so far, some of these names you may have heard, Zeus, Bametal, Citadel, Zero Access. These were the names of the most notorious botnets Those were infecting millions and millions of PCs across the world, and they were doing all kinds of damage, all kinds of criminal activity. You can see, it started with WOM. They were doing, majorly we found spam bots, like Roostock was one of the biggest spam bot in the world, sending 30 billion spam a day. When you took it down, almost the net traffic was impacted because they were not sending spam anymore. We talk about Zeus was the first financial bot that we took down. Nitol was the first one where we found the IT supply chain, which was unsecure, was bringing malware inside organizations and consumers and impacting them criminally. We had Citadel was one of the most malicious financial bot. We took it down. We disrupted that network. There were 5 million computers spread across 90 countries, which were part of the Citadel botnet. And it was a financial bot. It would keylog your username, password. So if you go on and access ICCI.com or accessbank.com, the Citadel will get activated, and it will track your every keystroke after you have accessed a financial website. And then they will keylog your username, password, and hijack your account. By the time we took it down, it had cost $500 million worth of losses. And we believe that is something, a small number, than the banks actually suffered. So we're looking at Game Over Zeus, Bladder Bindi, and Zenxious. I want you to pay attention because you're going to see some data on India. And that will surprise you. And that will probably unsettle you a bit in terms of how safe do we feel we are in terms of malware attacks. B106, just remember that, Kapow, and we continue to do more operations. So you will ask me, what have you done here? What do we do is, we are disrupting the command and control of the botnet operators, the cyber criminals who are running servers or who are running domain networks or peer-to-peer networks. There's a lot of technology involved in that. We have the ability, both the technical side and the legal side, and not alone. Again, Microsoft does not do it alone. We do it with partners. We are able to bring legal action against those criminals and take control of their command and control. So those command and control are disconnected from the millions of PCs which are infected and which are part of the zombie army I was speaking about. So when the zombie army does not receive command from the criminals, those computers in a way get protected, but only partially because malware is still there inside their computers. The bigger part is how do we clean that malware? There's a lot of work which goes on there. But what we do here is we are doing collaboration across industry partners to bring that cyber criminal down. Because we believe if you don't take the fight to the criminal, we're only defensive. The entire world is just defensive. Build better antivirus, anti-malware. We should obviously do that. But if you don't make their cost of operations harder, these criminals will not, they'll be relentless. They will always be coming up. So we as Microsoft believe we have to go and fight those so we can be very, we can keep our network, our environment more safer. So an example of the cleanups, I mean, before the slide, next slide, the percentages I'm showing you here is the reduction of infections that we have enabled after the takedowns, and we're looking at probably a month or a 2 month back. So sometimes it has taken 3 years to bring down to 99%. Sometimes it has taken us, typically cloud technology has taken us 1 year to bring the infection down by, say, 84%. The last one you see, it was done in July, and within a year, less than a year, we were able to bring the infections down. And there's a lot more collaboration, and we'll see what I'm talking about here. So let me show you the latest action we've done. How many of you heard of Ramnet botnet? Very few, right? This was taken down just a couple of weeks back. We worked with Symantec. We worked with Europol. FSISAC is the largest financial body looking into cybersecurity of the banking industry, and NCA of UK and several other partners. We worked for several months to study this Ramnet. It is a financial botnet. It used to steal passwords. It used to do web injection fraud. Thereby, they would target a certain bank, and if that bank's subscribers would open that portal to access online banking, the web injection fraud would introduce a code into that website, which none of us can see, that there's a code sitting on top of the website, and as you enter your username password, you will see it's a legitimate website I shouldn't be afraid of, and they will capture your data. It had infected close to 3.5 million computers across the world. And I'll show you some data when I said we should be surprised where India stands in terms of all the infections. So this is our cyber threat intelligence program, which forms the core of our work in fighting against cybercrime. And when we are disconnecting computers from the command and control of the cyber criminals, the malware, we all know malware, right? Malware is designed to reach out to its controller, or to its commander, and it seeks command. What should I do today? Should I steal some document? Should I steal some password? Should I, you know, hack into any account? What should I do? The malware is designed to keep going back to its parent or to its controller seeking command. And we are able to study that malware information, which is trying to reach out to a malware server that is coming to a DCU sinkhole in US. And in that sinkhole, we are able to study that malware information, which is a criminal information coming from those computers, which are victims' computers. And we are able to then sinkhole it and use some of the big data analytics capabilities, Power BI, Office 365, SharePoint, Office Azure SQL Server, and so on and so forth, to visualize what the threats are like, where they are, which part of the world they are, what type of customers they could be, right? And we can make an assessment and analytics of about you see Windows Azure? We are sharing that intelligence back to the CERTs. I'm sure you all know CERTs, Computer Emergency Response Teams. Almost every country has it. They're the cyber defense side of the governments, right? Like you have Army, Navy, and Air Force. They look after the cyberspace. We are giving intelligence back to the hands of the CERTs, absolutely free of cost. We are giving it to the ISPs so they can use that data to see if any of their subscribers or their networks are infected. And now, importantly, our cloud customers can access that intelligence. And that is something which has happened in the last 8 to 9 months. And that is the reason I think you'll be interested to see how that intelligence is getting back into the hands of our customers. And that is what makes our work, when I showed you those percentages that they were coming down, because we are giving it to CERTs, we are giving it to ISPs, they are doing advisories, they are doing alerts. It is getting into the patches, into the security updates, antivirus partners who work with us, they're able to release signatures, and when product updates or new products are being installed, these malware is getting cleaned. So ultimately, when we are fighting cybercrime, we are also enabling cleaning of the machines and trying to create a safer internet environment. So you will be curious what the visualization and insights I'm talking about, right? Let me run a power map video just for India, and let's see what that looks like. So what you see here is all the infections at this point of time for India and the Asia region, but we have the ability to go deep from a regional level. We can go deep into, like, what you're seeing is the Chennai city, where we're able to study the botnets that we have taken down on the left side. You can see, we can see that Calcutta has the maximum infections of, say, B106. And I told you, remember B106? It's a family of 200 malware that was part of the operation. This is the level of intelligence when we generate, we are able to make very informed decisions working with CERTs and ISPs to identify where the victims are. Because these victims are not aware that they were infected. And sometimes they're not even aware that they have lost money or they have lost privacy or they have lost so much. But when you're able to see this, we are able to make intelligence decisions about who is attacking whom. Because it can be different. A particular bot operator can target Japan in a different way, and they can target India in a different way because they're targeting a certain section of the industry or a certain section of the population. So this big data analytics is what we have churned basis the malware intelligence that we have at the data at our cybercrime center. And that is what, and I think what you see here is maybe Pune, and I know this is Bangalore. This is Bangalore. So this is something which is interesting for us to observe and study. And that allows us to build better understanding of what security features are necessary in our products and services. This allows us to stay ahead of the curve on cybersecurity. So I said, I ran a report for you all to see. Report ran from 9 to 15th March. Top 25 countries by threat, which we have taken down and disrupted, India is number one, right? Then you have Pakistan and then Egypt and so on and so forth. There is definitely lots to be done in terms of, you know, why there's so much insecurity and infections out there. 7 countries are from the Asia region. And you know, Asia region is where 60% of the world population resides. That is the next growth of IT consumption. I think we all need to work harder for a cleaner environment and for a safer technology usage. Let's see, I pulled just the India data, and within 1 week, we were seeing close to 2 million IP addresses which were infected by the bots have reached out to DCU Sinkhole 219 million times in 1 week. I'll advise you not to take a picture of this, but I think you should know what type of data we are analyzing. And you can see the top threats by the volume, and you can see the color coding of how they match. Now, you want to see which cities are most infected in India? These are top three threats I've already mentioned. You're talking about Delhi, number one, followed by Mumbai, Chennai, Bangalore, Kolkata, Hyderabad, New Delhi, Pune, and also and so forth, right? And that is able to, now that is something what we call it actionable intelligence. So if India CERT, which receives data from us, as I said, it's all free of cost, and we have to get ISPs on board soon enough, they can decide, because what they get is geolocated a range of IP addresses. So they can see the entire IP range for the Indian subcontinent, and they can then decide, okay, this could be a government, this could belong to an enterprise, these could be consumers, and they're able to then reach out or release advisories, tools, and different patches which can allow them to clean. But this is something which allows us to build better security features in our products as well, because we're able to research. So Ramnet I spoke about, it spread to 185 countries, so within a week, or 10 days, we were able to, again, use some big data analytics at a center to study where the infections were, and we found out it was spread over 185 countries. And we are continuously studying that botnet activity by the hour, and we are able to find new and new victims across the world. The threat by the continent, Asia was the largest infected by this Ramnet botnet. It's a very, very advanced and sophisticated form of botnet. And we see India is at number one, followed by Indonesia, and other countries. And that is where, again, we have to think of where the technology we need to go to, which would be more safer, more secure, and how on-prem environment has its own weaknesses, because you are your own security firm in itself, but whereas where are cyber criminals are attacking, where they are going, and that is something which we must always consider when you think of trusted cloud and disruptive technology. So when it comes to the trust, and I won't go deep into these principles, Jay has already covered, but the fundamental is it's your data. And Jay referred to it, nobody has access to your data. And that is our fundamental belief. That is our principle. That data which comes to a cloud is your data. You own it, you run it. We are accountable to you, and we are responsible to manage and secure that data. And then we have all the principles. Where DCU fits in terms of fighting cybercrime and leveraging threat intelligence is the built-in security. That is one of the features that we have, which adds more. So, as I mentioned, we are removing criminal controls of the bots. You say we're disconnecting the command and control. We are attacking non-genuine software. Piracy and counterfeiting are very malicious vectors for malware to come in. We must realize if you ever use non-genuine, the malware is coming in. The studies have shown. The Truth Labs report in India had shown 6 out of 10 PCs with non-genuine software came with pre-installed malware. National University of Singapore study shown 6 out of 10 PCs are coming with malware. So we need to attack that source. So we are going after organized crime, and we're cleaning the internet as much as we can. We are able to authenticate data. You saw the India power map. We are able to see where the victims are. But we don't see who they are. We don't see which machines they have. We're only able to see IP addresses. And that is the malware information. We don't even read that malware information because that's encrypted. We're only able to see the information which is going to a malware server comes to us through legal process, and we're able to make that decision. So we are authenticating what PCs are at risk. But importantly, now the data is getting back to our customers through cloud technology, and I will show you what that means. So Azure Active Directory, I will not spend a word explaining what that means. All the previous speakers were highly expert in that, in what that identity and access management is all about. But what we have enabled through the work which DCU does, that we have enabled authentication of sign-ins, an additional layer of sign-ins. So assuming you have 500 employees and they all come in the morning and log into your network. But you don't know if any of those machines are infected, right? Sometimes you know, sometimes you don't know, because botnets are very, very sophisticated. What this allows us to do is to, because Azure Active Directory is feeding from the data from DCU, it can real time can check if any of the sign-ins happened from a suspected infection. In real time, in your premises, you can do reports like this every day and see if any of the devices were infected. You can isolate them, you can clean them up, but that is only the start of the story. Once you know which devices were infected, you are looking at a much bigger problem which you don't see otherwise. It could be many more malware could be present inside. So this feature, which has been built into Azure Active Directory, gives you a much more additional layer of security than you would find in any cloud provider. What that means, there are various reports which Active Directory generates. We call it anomaly reports. Something is not right about those, so those are suspicious, and IT administrators and IT managers should be able to, security professionals should be able to see, I should know what is right, what is not right. It generates various reports. I will not go deep, but just look at the number of reports the Azure AD Directory Premier prepares for you. Unknown sources, multiple failures, multiple geographies, right? Global companies, employees are mobile, addresses from with suspicious activity, irregular sign-in activity, anomalous sign-in activity, right? But where does DCU come in? Here. It also allows you, in addition to all these security reports, it allows you to see if there are possible infected devices in the environment. And we were able to do this only because we were able to, we had an inclination, a commitment to fight cybercrime, generate intelligence, and then make sure that the machines are addressed, machines are cleaned, but also now customers can access this data, which earlier it was not, because this is something that has happened in the last 1 year. We were only giving it to the certs and ISPs. But with cloud technology is the new way where your data will be more secure than any of the on-prem environment we are talking about. And I always think of JP Morgan, which was the gold standard in the financial industry, and they were breached. And for a cloud provider, it is a matter of life and death if any breach happens in that. And for a cyber criminal, it will take him years to decrypt the encryption levels the cloud center data centers have. And by the time, it will not spend years fighting the data center security. It will go where it's easiest. It will go where it's piracy. It will go where it's unmanaged IT environment. There's no patching, no updates. You're using older products, you know, and you know, your controls, your vendors, your suppliers, your employees, those are not in place. Cybersecurity is a comprehensive people, process, technology. So this is something which we want to empower our customers. They can run these reports, and they can have a much better understanding of what type of suspicious activity is going on. Because you must remember, when a criminal enters into an environment, it doesn't start stealing immediately. A study has shown that a malware can reside without being detected for an average period of 243 days before they can even be discovered that they have done some damage. Sometimes they are just fishing for activity where they should attack, and then they'd make their kill. But before that, they're studying activity. So if you're not able to detect that malicious sign-ins or anomalous activity, you may miss that something is going wrong in my environment. Azure Active Directory allows you to do that. So I will go quickly. I'm almost finished. I heard many speakers speak about operational insight, how it is a tool for the IT operations team, and how it gleans data across various environments, all kinds of data. But what AD, Operational Insight also does, it feeds from the DCU sinkhole, and it can also see if there is any malware or malicious activity from any devices. So again, it's something which adds a lot of value to IT operations team. So we have a project going on with the financial sector. I just wanted to just give you a short introduction that we are working very closely with the FSI sector, because a lot of the new form of criminal activity is targeting banks. It's targeting financial institutions, it's targeting online banking, e-commerce, and that is where we have a close partnership with FSI SAC, which has 5,000 plus member banks. We are doing a pilot with 12 banks across these continents, and ultimately this is about sharing intelligence. So banks, if they face any malware attack, they will be sharing with DCU, We can probably build an operation out of it, but we are also giving the data back to them. So banks can take immediate steps to defend their networks, but also to alert their subscribers when they're doing online banking if there's any malware or suspicious activity from them. So this is something which we will see how in future this unfolds, but this is something we are doing it through cloud technology. So at the end, this is my last slide. I want to very, very clearly and expressly provide some commitments to you in terms of how do we protect data and privacy. And these are very clear commitments that we have. We do not provide any government with direct, unfettered access to customers' data. And we don't just say it in a closed room. This is a public statement. We do not provide any government with encryption keys or assist their efforts to break our encryption. And you know what revealed, you know, from the Snowden, the trust factor came into picture. How do we trust whatever Snowden sell? We have been very, very clear. We do not engineer backdoors into our products. We have never provided business or government data in response to a national security order. For us, data of our customers, its privacy, its security is supreme. Even if it's national security order, that does not mean that we automatically, immediately give the data. There's a legal process which has to be followed. There's a due diligence which has to be done. We just don't want to hand over data. And that is the confidence we want our customers to have when they entrust us. The last part, sometimes which customers outside of US worry, can US government access our data? And we will contest any attempt by US government to access data which does not reside in United States, which means data centers across the world, non-US data centers. We believe US government does not have right to access that data. They can access data working with governments, directly asking the customer. That's okay. They can manage. But when they come to Microsoft and say, hand over the data to me, we are fighting that. And we believe we cannot hand over that data to them. And you would have heard there's a case going on in US court, and we are fighting head on against the US government. So these are our very clear commitments to our customers about how we respect privacy, security, and transparency of the data of our customers. With that, thank you very much.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
We have some nice gifts to give for best
questions.
Sorry,
we ran a little over time, but we had the luxury of being the last session, so we do have time for questions, and yeah, we do have some goodies to give away for good questions as well. So let me go to somebody who,
I will start with the last slide. We are trying to set up enterprise-level, production-grade risk engine on the cloud. I work for SocGen, Societe Generale, a financial institution, Universal Bank. So one question which is coming back to the table again and again is the Patriot Act. So we just made clear on the last point saying that you're not going to hand over any customer data. But if you look at the phrase, what the Patriot Act normally mandates is that any American company which is operating outside or anywhere internationally must provide the data requested if it is related to terrorist act or anything related to the national security. So it's a bit unclear, because at one side we said that we are fighting, but there is no clear conclusion. So can you please provide some insights where it is heading, and what is your personal opinion, whether we are going to secure the data or it's going to be very tough?
No, I think our commitment is what we have said is what we are committed to. There is no anomaly, or there is no kind of misinterpretation of what we are saying here, right? See, we are not a company which says we don't cooperate with law enforcement, right? Law enforcement has to work with private sector in various ways. They need to, and there has to be a partnership, and there's a clear legal process through which data has to be obtained, right? Our principle is, when the data does not belong to a customer who's a US customer, right? That data, under what law that US government has jurisdiction over that data, especially when the data does not reside in the US, and that company is not a US corporation. And that is where our commitment is, that US can obtain the data through other means. But what we are battling is, it cannot simply subpoena Microsoft and say, you own the data centers, hand it over to us. At least we are saying it very clearly and openly, and that's what our principles are. I'm not sure how other cloud providers react to this, but we actually have a case where we are refusing to hand over an Irish national's data to the US government.
So if you look at it, we are a multinational financial institution where we have clients who would be transacting across the nationalities. And certainly US government do have a very strong point when they say that they would like to track the financial cash flows from one country to another. Yeah.
What we're saying, and I think that's what I mentioned, they can go to that particular company and say, give me this data. Correct?
Okay.
So when they come to Microsoft unilaterally, and as we say, it's your data, it's not Microsoft data, we are a provider, right? We want to draw a line. We are not saying that data can never be shared. Point is, we have to follow legal process. US government has better means to receive that data as compared to asking Microsoft to hand over. And there's a legal process which is followed.
Yeah.
It's a comprehensive in terms of what process, how they need to interact with Microsoft, and what we don't do.
And the second question is, are we collaborating with the other cloud providers to tackle this issue?
Tackle the issue of cybercrime?
Not the cybercrime, but the data securitization of the customers.
Some of the companies actually stand by what Microsoft is doing. There are companies, I won't name them, but they supported the Microsoft stand. Because what happens is, it takes away the trust of our customers outside of US when they have to work, and it impacts every cloud provider who's out there. They have the same issues as Microsoft. You're right. And they have even filed some amicus brief and things like that in the lawsuit that we have before the courts.
Hello.
My question is,
I have a question regarding the role-based access to Microsoft Azure services. Suppose a user creates a VM which can be accessed. This VM can be accessed by the another user. That is the shared VM. And suppose there is a role, admin role, who create the VM. Now there are some other roles, like a developer role and tester roles. So for same shared VM, these another roles user can access to the VM or not. So is there any provision for role-based access for a shared Microsoft Azure services?
See, on the platform, we don't do anything. So as an administrator, you can delegate that responsibility. We give you the capability to do that on how, what kind of responsibility you want to give to different people in a project in terms of, you know, whether they are a tester, developer, administrator of a production instance, and so forth. But so we give you the capability to define those kind of things, but we don't do that. You will have to do that, yeah.
Subscription for each user?
No, so you don't have to. Depends. So you can have separate deployments within the same subscription, or you can have multiple subscriptions, and you can have co-administrators and so forth. So there's multiple ways to do that. Okay. So, yeah, we give you capabilities through which you can do it.
I have another question regarding the natural disasters.
Sorry?
Natural disasters. Okay. As you told, if we create some data in one region, let's say Pune, and this data cannot be replicated on out of India. So some natural disaster happened in India. So what happened with my data?
So like I said, so you get to choose whether it's local redundant or geo-redundant, right? So if you go geo-redundant, and let's say we have multiple data centers within India, and there will be at least, you know, the standard thing of, I think, about 500 kilometers of distance between two data centers as a minimum, right? So even if a natural disaster strikes the primary data center and you have opted for geo-redundancy, your data will be available on the DR site.
So using the geo-redundancy, We can put the data between the multiple countries.
Between multiple countries? See, so in a region like Europe, it is the data centers are across two countries, so it automatically happens. But let's say if you wanted to do it between multiple regions, let me take an example where you say, okay, I want to replicate the data between Europe and US. We don't do it out of the box. You will have to do it. You can implement it yourself, but we will not be doing it as part of the service.
Thank you. Quick question here regarding the... cloud has infinite computing capability, right? Can that be misused by malicious attackers where they spawn unlimited cloud instances, and is Microsoft doing anything to block that, block malicious people from doing that?
So yes, it can be done. So as per the standard agreement, right, so one of the things is that, you know, we try and secure your deployment from an attack from outside, but we also monitor such that somebody else is not leveraging our platform to launch an attack itself, right? And there is, so when you sign up as a user for Azure, there is a clause that says that you should not be using the platform and the resources on the platform for launching this kind of a malicious attack. And you, there will be a process that will follow if something like that happens.
My question is about infrastructure as a service. If I choose to host a virtual environment, virtual server on Azure Cloud, and I use it for test. This is just a scenario, and I use this server for my test environment, and I am lazy enough of not patching for operating system patching of those image. So what kind of protection still my environment will have if I choose to host on Azure?
Well, you can, so if you, you know, one option is you can automate, you can choose to receive auto updates and things. Or the other option is, you know, there are certain things that we do at the platform level to secure your VM, right? But like I said, it's a shared responsibility, right? What we do at the platform level will not be sufficient, especially if you're using infrastructure as a service VM. So there is a minimum expectation on what you should be doing. So there, so we will not have any kind of SLA or guarantee that your VM is secure.
I have a question for Keshav. Thanks for sharing this information on the sinkholing. You know, it creates a lot of positive impact. But if you look at the figures, they're huge, you know, millions. Now if you look at the frauds that are happening, nobody would deny that frauds are happening. But then the data, when I look at it from the figures there, and the volume to which frauds are happening, they don't really match. So should we credit the inability of the botnet architects? Or do we just thank God that the fraudulent usage, despite such a huge botnet content, is not really translating into that huge a financial impact?
I think one thing you would have noticed, the data is limited. The data which I showed you is not the data of the world. The data is the ones that we have disrupted. The data reflects those numbers of those botnet. Of course, they're the largest of the largest bot. There could be many other malware families which are still operational, and they're still committing fraud. And that is the point, I think you're absolutely right, that the fraud may be much higher than what the data reflects. But
I'm saying the devil's advocate. I'm saying that the figures, but fraud on the ground. Otherwise, if I try to correlate these figures and even the botnets that exist,
right,
almost every bank would be out of business. But that's not the case.
Features
But
so whom do we credit for a lower impact on the ground because of all these
monitoring? You mean why the situation exists that there's so much infections? I'm trying to understand your question. You say who do we credit for? Lower. Oh, you're saying less fraud? See, I told you, Citadel example, I tell you. We estimated $500 million losses. But banks did not disclose actual losses. Financial sector is very secretive about disclosing what attacks they face, what breaches have happened. It's their reputation which is at risk. Not every organization will ever reveal, hey, I lost data of my customers and I had this breach, I lost my IP and, you know, this kind of disruption happened. Cybersecurity is a non-collaborative effort at this point of time. We are trying to break through that notion of don't keep cybersecurity as a closed door conversation, because if you don't share experiences with your partners or with the industry, nobody can learn what happened in that incident. So many of the times, you will not find cyber attacks or breaches being disclosed. So to quantify the total loss, it is very difficult. The cybercrime is today almost close to a $300 billion industry globally. That's the estimate the experts have. But in terms of how much, say, the NCR region lost, or say the Mumbai lost, who can tell the figures? If everybody is disclosing, okay, I faced a breach, I lost this account, then you quantify the value of that information. All that is not happening. We are trying to bring that information out to the stakeholders and saying, let's be real. Let's please be open about cybersecurity, because this is all over. And if we keep secrets, it's like if we don't share because out of shame or out of reputational issues, then you're not doing anybody any benefit. So that's the reason why we don't see the actual quantification. Absolutely. No, I think for us, we have been the PC industry of the world, right? I mean, we have faced attacks like never before. We have the largest footprint on that industry. I think in terms of what we have done is more of a very openly disclosing and also sharing. Otherwise, we would have just kept these things within us. And this is not even a revenue model for us. Sorry, you wanted to say anything?
Can I ask a question over here? This side. Okay. Yeah. So basically, the cloud environment is being used by multiple organizations as such. Can there be, now Microsoft is doing whatever is possible to protect that particular platform. Is it possible that because of a user as a company, there could be some potential threats which could be induced within the system, and then the company could be held liable, which probably puts risk to other organizations' data?
So if I understand, can you repeat the question? So the company would be held liable for?
So what I'm saying is, so let us say there are hundreds of companies on Microsoft Azure. Okay. Now, one of the company, because of their security not in place, okay, is there a possibility that that can induce risk to other users or other organizations?
No.
I'm not in the software architect of the cloud, but I think, yeah.
No, so, like I said, right, so we have a clear isolation between different customers on the platform, right? So them having a vulnerability would only be limited to them and will not expand or extend onto the deployment of a different customer.
But the underlying hardware would be shared, isn't it?
The underlying hardware should be shared, but we don't overcommit resources, right? So the hardware is pretty much dedicatedly allocated, whether it's CPU or memory and stuff like that. And also, each one's running on their own individual hypervisor, and we have a host OS, which is maintaining that segregation between the different guest virtual machines which are running.
So till the time it is virtual machines, it is fine. But if, for example, I want to save as an organization, if they are saving some data onto the hard disk as such, and that could have some potential risk with it. So ultimately, it is going onto the hard disk somewhere. Can that be a risk?
So you're saving something onto the hard disk, right? Again, that's data, again, that is segregated, right? So what you're saving is, you know, that becomes like a passive thing. The data that you've saved is a passive data, and that again is replicated onto a central storage, right? While we provide you with disks and stuff in the virtual machine, that again goes back into our Azure storage capability, where we have a centralized storage into which we store it on a more permanent basis. Okay. So there's a lot of checks and balances to ensure that something like that doesn't happen. Let me take a couple of questions there and then we'll come back.
I have a similar question on the same lines. Like, is there a possibility that deployment of multiple organizations, they share same physical resource, be it computational resource or storage resource or network resource? Physical resource I'm talking about.
Yes, they will. They
okay.
will share. Yes.
So do you see now new kind of threats because of this kind of deployment, because this is a new thing, and let's assume that there are malicious users now deploying onto Azure and trying to now exploit this kind of environment?
See, so in our environment, right, on a public cloud environment, so we, one of the things is we kind of standardize, and the way we are able to give you costs is because it's a standardized and it's a shared environment, right? So there's no dedicated capability. I will not, you know, on a, if I take a physical server, there'll be multiple virtual machines on that physical server, and, you know, so that virtual machines will obviously be spread across multiple customers. Similarly, I have storage disk arrays, right? And then the data of multiple customers will go into the disks, right? So I cannot dedicate disks to customers, right? That's the premise on which this whole thing works, and that's how we are able to scale it up and also give it to you at such low cost, right? So in that environment, there is no dedicated segregation at a physical level, right? All of the segregation only happens at a logical level, okay? Whether it is for the CPU resources or disk resources.
So do you see any new kind of threats because of this kind of deployment sharing environment?
So the way we've built the system is, we do not trust the user, right? We work under the assumption that, you know, we cannot trust you, we cannot trust what is the intent that the user may have. There may be malicious intents. So the system is designed in such a way that we can tackle those kind of risks.
All right, thank you.
One question. So I work for a financial auditing firm. So as you mentioned, financial companies are kind of apprehensive while adopting cloud. So we are going to adopt a hybrid cloud kind of strategy. So what would be the adequate security measures that should be taken when a company goes for a hybrid cloud model, that is extending an on-premise data center onto Azure?
It's a very wide question for me to answer. Maybe I can take it offline. But broadly, if I am to use the example of Microsoft, right? I mean, you said financial, but let me use the example of Microsoft, where you know, we have Microsoft IT, who provides all of our internal cater to all of our internal IT requirements. And today, they leverage Azure extensively. So there are things that, I mean, so I talked about 20 data centers that we operate for Azure, right? Besides that, we also operate several data centers for our own internal consumption, right? So they are complementing our existing internal IT data centers with Azure, right? So there are services that we do off Azure, right? So what we do is we classify the solutions based on criticality to business, right? So we have to look at what's the criticality to business, what's the kind of data that is associated with that solution, right? So is there employee data? Is there employee salary information or, you know, personally identifiable information? So those are the kind of filters that is that a solution is put through before it is deemed if we can take it to the public cloud or not, right? So same thing will extend to a bank or any other organization where they're on an application by application basis. They will have to evaluate whether that particular solution is ready for public cloud right? And again, this may be an ongoing process because I've seen in our own journey with MSIT, we started out with very, very small pieces of solutions moving to the public domain. And now we've got larger pieces moving. And as the maturity evolves, right, so your comfort and the trust with the platform also evolves along with it.
In a hybrid cloud model, is there any cloud service brokerage which Microsoft recommends?
Cloud service brokerage?
Brokerage, yeah.
No, nothing as that.
Because we have many cloud service brokerage models in market, like Jamcracker, Cisco has some.
Yeah, I know.
So is
I
there
know.
Any recommendation for from Microsoft?
At this cloud? Point, there's nothing that we exclusively promote.
Okay.
Okay.
Yes, you, sir. Yes, sir.
I have a question regarding to the FSI when you are talking about.
This is regarding to FSI security case. Suppose you have a application on your mobile, right? And I want to access the Citibank application. And similarly, I want to access the application from browser itself, from the device, from the mobile. So how you are tracking out the threats and the botnet kind of thing when it is totally on the mobile side, not we are accessing from the PC?
Right, and I think our effort so far has been on the PC, on the computer side of the botnet operations, because the ecosystems are also not unified at this point of time. But with time, we know that, especially with Windows 10 coming, we will have the same operating system on the Windows mobile and on PCs and on larger screens. And we will be able to track any of those infections, which could be even on mobile as well as on PCs alone. But the actions we've done so far are typically largely focused on the malware which was designed to attack computers, not largely devices like mobile phones. But for us, even cross-platform is the way forward because Microsoft is just not about a Windows platform anymore. Our products are available in iOS and Android environments, and future we will know what we can do even in that environment to fight cybercrime. But at this point of time, I cannot give you any particular example.
So the Microsoft is actually using the Xamarin, where you can actually go and access on Android, iOS, and Windows as well. So do you have any API which we can integrate in our application so that we can handle it, or it is still in the development mode?
I don't know if I can answer as a lawyer, right? I'm not into product development. Anything, Jay, you want to contribute? Or maybe we should take it offline because I may not have the information to answer the question you're asking me, to be honest.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah.
Hello.
Okay.
Yes. With regards to data security and privacy, is there any legal agreement signed between Microsoft and their customers with regards to data privacy and security?
Yes. So pretty much all of the things that we talked about are in the standard clauses that we sign, whether you sign through online or through other means. And like I said, so there are separate contractual clauses that we get into for healthcare and FSI. Those are more like amendments to the standard clauses, but the standard clauses, yeah, are there, yes, as part of the, so even if you go online, as part of the terms and conditions, they are there.
Question here.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, sir. While choosing the location for the data storage, let's say we are choosing Europe or Singapore, do we need to follow any regulations of that specific country where your data center is located?
Do I need to follow what, sir?
I mean, any regulations, we need to comply with their rules, I mean.
See,
Or no, I mean,
usually the question is the other way. So
okay. Sure.
You know, you choose the country because
okay.
you want
okay.
you to follow the regulation.
Yeah, okay, let me
I don't
ask.
Know if you have to follow
yeah,
the regulation
the
because
question.
You chose the country.
Yeah, question for you.
Say we are storing our data in Singapore, okay, Singapore data center. In case of any trouble, I mean, in case Singapore government needs to access those data, are they able to get data from Microsoft, or still Microsoft will deny? I mean,
yes.
Because I'm asking a question, because see, the data is
yes.
located in the Singapore itself.
Yeah,
yeah. So. Yes, I think our commitment does not change about how Singapore can access data. Do they have jurisdiction over the data? Are they following the legal process to open the data? What is the justification of asking that data?
Understand.
See, what we are very clear is nobody can just come and ask any data from us. Mm. For whatever reasons they are thinking that's the good reason for them to ask. They have to really go through why they need it, what legal process have they followed, what is the case all about.
Understand.
Does Microsoft has any role to play in it, or you know they need to go through the legal process? So Singapore government wants to accept the data, they can't simply come and ask the data.
Okay,
from us.
That's fine.
That's simple as that.
And one more technical question, a very quick one. Let's say we are using a mobile service, okay, or say blog storage. Now, if there are any malwares and someone has launched a network attack, the API count will keep on increasing, right? Because the call will come to the API service, the mobile service, okay? Is there any parameter where we can configure, like if from specific IP address, if like 100 requests coming per second, then just block it? Kind of security, is there, I mean, is it implemented right now or not really?
That's in the Azure, right?
Yeah, in Azure. Yeah.
Yeah, all these reports are, I think Jay can answer those, but I think there's anomalous, that would be very anomalous behavior for Azure to detect immediately.
Yeah.
So we watch for such patterns through which we can detect it. And you know, we talked about the insights, right? Through insights, you can look at it. You can implement access control lists, but then if you don't know the IP address beforehand, right?
Yeah.
How do you implement it? Yeah, so, but we provide you the capability to detect these things, right? But then to implement it would be
okay, so we have
part.
To take action. Azure itself will not take any action on that.
You can automate it. I mean, you have to take action in the sense you can automate it to take action. Right, so we provide you with the capability to detect these, and then you can either take action manually or through an automated process.
Okay, so if we want to do that, we have to have use insights. Is it like that? I mean, insights.
Not necessarily. Insights is one option, right? So you could use multiple options on how you wanted to do it. You could do it within your application itself, for instance, right? So let's say if your application itself, you can do it. You don't have to use insights, but insights is one option. Yes.
Yeah, that's fine, but it will add again.
I will not do it because I have no idea. Like I said, everything I handle it as a black box.
Yeah.
Right? So if you're seeing that there is a sudden spike,
yeah.
As far as Azure is concerned, we will detect a spike and we may alert you. But I do not know whether that is a malicious spike or if it is a genuine spike.
Understand. So can you just name the mechanism of alerting which is there, I mean, which we can use? I mean, one of which is inside that you say. Do you know of anything else? I mean, we can set alert.
So, see, you can...
See, because in mobile service, it's not there. I mean, I'm using
mobile
it already.
Mobile service, yeah. So, we don't have a thing for mobile services out of the box today. No.
Yeah.
We don't do it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Question for you. Question for you from here. Sorry. Right here. Straight down the middle.
Hello?
Straight down the middle, right here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. You spoke about giving access, or rather not giving access to the US government to, for data that's hosted on Azure. Now, I'm just going to turn that around. This is a scenario we faced recently where the ownership of data rested with the US government, and it was hosted on Azure. And the question was, how would Microsoft react to being served a legal subpoena from a private entity? So if Microsoft is served with a legal subpoena by a private entity requesting information which is actually owned by the US government, how would you react to that?
Private entity asking the data belong to the US government.
That's right.
That means US government was using our cloud services.
Yes.
Right?
That's right.
Legal process.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Ultimately, the legal subpoena will tell us why the data, court will authorize that legal subpoena, compel us, right?
Right.
And we will study that subpoena to see why US government was not directly approached for collection of the data or obtaining of the data. Why was Microsoft served?
Correct.
If the data belongs to the US government, right? And I'm assuming the case is filed in US.
Yes, it
right?
was.
Right? Yes. There lies the answer. Why would you come to Microsoft to release that data when the court can tell the US government, I order you to release the data to me for this case, because this is whatever case is, evidence is there, or material fact, or whatever, Microsoft will not be party to that case. The court can directly go to the US government, correct?
That's absolutely right. But if the government department refuses to hand over data, specific data, to the private entity that it is in a contract with, and that might result in the private entity filing a legal subpoena to request data from Microsoft directly. How would Microsoft react to that?
Assuming Microsoft have to hand over, we will make sure that, you know, I'm saying the extreme cases where everyone says, no, I think the data has come to, first of all, we'll challenge it.
Okay.
That's what we're fighting the court.
Right.
We challenge it. You prove that you have justification for us to give the data because the data doesn't belong to you, right? Second would be whether the data is only available with us, and you know, and government cannot access it, because government can access the data from our data centers.
Yeah.
And hand it over.
Yeah.
So for us, it's basically, it's very clear demarcation in terms of what does Microsoft has to play a role in the data transfer or the change or handing over the data, where it has, you know, what is that role with us that we have?
Also, yeah. There are specific data centers available in the US which only handle government workloads. There's one data center in Iowa, if I'm not mistaken. There might be additional data centers which are meant only for government and public, large public workloads. So are your policies towards services offered in those data centers different from other data centers?
Well, the data centers serving the government, public data centers, right? I think, Tom, do you have any insights? But I'm sure. Just a sec. Tom, there's a mic coming behind you. I want to also understand the question. I think he's talking about the data which is for the government alone.
Yeah, I mean, we do have federal data centers, and we do screening on staff because that's the requirement from the government. But beyond that, the infrastructure works the same way. It's accredited, securitized, the same way as everybody expects from other data centers globally.
So from an operations perspective, I don't think we know anything different.
Yeah, I think more.
Hello.
Yes, customer agreements basically control, and I think more, we don't make, you know, I don't think that we will handle your data differently. They're also our customers, right? You know, and governments are customers of ours in outside of US as well. So I think, I don't have the exact terms and conditions, but, you know, but I don't think we do any major differentiation.
Yeah. One basic.
I think we need to.
So we'll probably take two more questions in the interest of time.
Yeah.
Before,
yeah.
But we'll
yeah.
be here to talk to the rest of
yeah.
you.
Yeah. One basic question is that the cloud service totally, you know, based on the internet, right? Finally.
Yeah.
Cloud service basically based on the internet, right? Depend on the internet completely. So let's say one client has taken, you know, a service from the Microsoft. If any issues, there's something like, you know, low response because of internet issue, anything, network, anything. So is there any tool with the Microsoft that can identify in a smart way that where is the issue lying at the Microsoft with the ISP or at the client in the network, whole network?
Jerry, you didn't get the question.
Yeah.
So
my question is that, if client is getting the low response from the cloud, speed, in case of speed or something kind of service,
okay.
Right? So now client will complain to Microsoft or maybe internet, ISP, whatever, right? So
right.
Is there Microsoft has some solution, can find out the where is the issue lying at the Microsoft end or at the ISP end,
right.
Or the client
okay.
end?
So our SLA, all of our SLAs are based upon the, you know, minimum guarantee that you should be able to ping or, you know, access the service that you are getting, right? So if you're not able to access the service, right, and that means in a case where the service itself is down, then we take liability for it and responsibility for it. But if it is more of a network issue between of a connectivity between your location and the Microsoft data center, since we do not have control over the pipe, we do not take ownership for that.
No, my question
right.
is, see, even pinging
so,
is...
Yeah, so we can help you.
Yeah, pinging is if not able to ping, there's a big issue, something network, but I'm saying slow. So I'm importing some data from the cloud, right? The speed is very slow, right? Compared
uh-huh.
to, right? So at that time, how do you identify? If client is complaining to Microsoft, the speed
see,
is...
See, so since we do not own, like I said, so since we do not own the network pipe, right?
Right.
So especially the last mile connectivity. So we partner with a lot of telecom providers and other players, but we do not have ownership of it. So we cannot take responsibility for it. I mean, we can help you with some troubleshooting and so forth, but that's pretty much what we could do. So
okay.
I'll go to that gentleman because he's had his hand up for a long time.
Right,
and that will probably be the last question. So is Hare Krishna still in the room? Is there a Hare Krishna in the room?
Okay.
Is there a Disha in the room? No? Okay, I guess there were two people who were actually tweeting faster than we were speaking. So I just wanted to...
Yeah, so my question is about the express route that you mentioned about. So express route, this feature is available in data centers in Asia region.
Yes.
And if it is there, because I just tried to use it on the Azure portal, and it was saying that it is still under development and it will be available soon.
So we've launched Express Routes the capability for our data centers in Singapore and Australia at this point in time.
So in Asia?
In Asia, so Singapore and Australia have Express Route capability.
Okay.
And we'll be having Japan and Hong Kong also, and China as well.
How Microsoft is ensuring that the express routes are secure, because
so
it will be like collaboration with the different ISPs, right?
Yes. So we are tying, not ISPs, we are tying up with different telecom providers, the likes of, so the US, AT&T, or in UK, we are tied up with British Telecom. In the Asia region, we're tied up with Singtel, and I think Telstra as well. And in India, we're in discussions with other local telecom providers through whom you will do it. So one option is through the telecom route, or the other option is through a partner, hosting partner route, and we have partnered with Equinix. And so there is an exclusive session tomorrow in the morning that talks about express route and how you would do it. So I would recommend that you attend that session tomorrow.
Okay, sure, thanks.
Okay, I think it's time to give the bags. All the best questions. So. Just please, we have so many questions got asked. It's very interesting. Just raise your hands to ask the questions.
Anybody who asks a question.
All right.
I don't know how many bags you have.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You were about to ask a question. okay. So we have.
Seven. I gave away one.
All right. So everyone gets the bag now. Maybe those who asked and left.
Thank you.
Please
thank
come
you
one by one. Yeah, thank you.
Staying back so late. And like I said, so Keshav and I will still be here, so please feel free to go. All right.
Thank you. Those who asked the questions.
There you go.
Thank you. Going fast.
And that's it. We're down.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Nice to meet you.